The following talk is offered freely to ensure that no one is ever denied access to these practices and to these teachings. If you feel inspired to make a donation to support this offering, you can go to my website at jonathanfaust.com. While you're there, you can also sign up for a monthly newsletter designed to support you in your practice. Thank you, and enjoy. This talk is an offering on ways to accompany others who are suffering. And I am trying to be as conscious as I can be of not recycling too much material. But this story, I usually, a good joke, I try to maybe keep it to once a year. But this is one of my favorites, and it just fits perfectly. It's the story of this old man on his deathbed, and he's surrounded by all these other old men, you know, his age. And they're all very, very sad, and the fellow who's on his deathbed suddenly opens his eyes, and he has tears in his eyes. He said, "You have been my best friends since grade school, and you've always been there for me, and you know, we've been drinking buddies, you know, these last, you know, 70 years, and I'm really, really grateful for all of you." And all the guys are crying. And so they just have one last request, you know, kind of honoring our relationship around enjoying drinking over these years. And it's a case of aged malt whiskey. It's in my basement, so a complete case. And if you would be okay with it, I would love for you on my birthday to take a liter of this and pour it over my grave. And all the guys are like, you know, they're all crying, and this one best friend is right there, goes, "We'll do anything." And the guy taps him on the shoulder and goes, "Well, excuse me." And they gather in the corner of the room and they're talking back and forth. And then they come back and his best friend comes in and he goes, "Would you mind if we pass it through our kidneys first?" Maybe not the most skillful way to be there for someone in their suffering. But I'd like to explore this topic a little bit tonight. And there are a couple things I'd like to cover. One is to share with you a time when I failed at being present for someone in their suffering. And when you explore what it means to be present for others, how important it is to look inward, to look at your own attitude, and look at your own stance in relationship to suffering. To talk a little bit about, well, what do you do? What are some of the best practices when you're wanting to support people? And finally, if you find yourself in the role of caregiver, some observations about what it's like when you are the one who is caring for others. So a number of years ago, many, many years ago, back in my ashram days, I had the opportunity to join the staff of a organization down in Puerto Rico called the Ann Wigmore Institute, if you haven't heard of it. It's a living foods community, and we were interested in maybe some joint ventures, and I was doing sort of a work share in with marketing for them and going through their programs and looking at how, or if there was anything to sync up between our communities. And when I got down there, the person I was working with was sort of the marketing and acting director, and he had leukemia but had really had a wonderful relapse through living foods, you know. So he was really devoting the rest of his life to educating people about the healing property of food. But while I was there, he was going through a very serious relapse. And it turned out that my time there with him was really taking care of him as he was going through his journey. And we had a good connection, and I was supporting him in a number of ways. And toward the very end, he was quite emaciated, and I told him as gently as I could that his wife and family were coming down that weekend to come and be with him. And there was a look of horror in his eyes, and the horror in his eyes really it sort of affected me. And I said some platitudes. I said, you know, these are the people who love you, and they want to be with you. You know, they want to see you. And he had trouble speaking, so it wasn't really easy to have a conversation, but kind of left it at that. And he ended up dying before they arrived. And as I look back, I realize how what I offered him, your family loves you, and so forth, was the best I could do at that time. But what I didn't do was to really lean in and explore that horror that he was feeling. I wasn't able to dialogue with him about that because I was too put off by it myself. You know, the existential fear I could see in his eyes. It was very clear he didn't want to be seen in that state. He didn't want to be remembered in that state. But I was unable to have that conversation with him because I wasn't able to be present to it. And when I hold this in the totality of my life, I know I did the best job I could, but there is that sense of there is a quality of being that I wasn't able to tap into. And you may reflect on times in your life when you were not able to be with people in your life who were going through suffering. And there are many reasons for it. It can be emotionally overwhelming. We can experience compassion fatigue. We just can't feel it anymore. Or maybe you're just too activated or scared or just unable to meet someone where they are in their suffering. And it's okay. But it's important to recognize how instrumental our relationship to suffering is. When the Buddha was asked, well, what is it you teach? Someone asked him on the road. He said, I teach only two things. I teach about suffering and freedom from suffering. So our whole life is in relationship to stress and to suffering. And everything we do is to alleviate it. Everything we do is to soothe our anxiety in some way. That might include, you know, working harder even though you're feeling scared. It may be closing off your heart to someone and not speaking the truth. It's driven by some desire to soothe your anxiety. I often think that just living your life is an incredible journey. Because as you live your life, you begin to see pretty clearly into three fundamental forces that pull you away from being present. They're all the different flavors of greed and desire, all the different flavors of aversion and judgment and blame and ill will, and confusion, the natural confusion that occurs in life. So much of your life is about really seeing through those forces to see what's true, to see where you're caught, pulled away by desire or greed, how you're pulled away by aversion, and how you can clear a confused mind. That's just you. You throw other people in the mix, it gets really messy, if you haven't noticed. As we used to say in the ashram, when we were all celibate, no relationship, no relationship problems. But then again, not having a relationship becomes the issue. And so you're never really free. So it's really important that you turn your attention to look closely at not only your relationship to suffering, but how you relate to other people in your life. Internally, when you feel stress, what it's like for you, and externally, how you act when you're under stress in relationship with others. And to really look at what is your relationship to giving and receiving. So a friend of mine has told this story. She's one of the most visual people I know. She's since died. But she always wore wild colors and loved art and just a super, super visual person. And she had all the characteristics. You know, people are really, really visual. If you haven't noticed, they tend to talk really, really fast because they've got these ideas. They want to get them out as quickly as they can. And they use their hands a lot because they're trying to show you what they're, you know, what's going on. But when she retired, she rented a little cottage on Martha's Vineyard in Oak Bluffs. It was a really funky little house, but the most important thing to her was right on the water. And so she had her table set up just to look right out the window and watch everything. And I would go to visit her a lot, again, many, many years ago, and hang out with her, and I loved her sense of style and so forth. And she told the story of, it was either a friend of hers or one of her kids who was coming to visit. And this person was sleeping in, so my friend Sheila made this great breakfast and set out this beautiful place and got some flowers from the garden and set them up. And had the guest of honor seat was giving up her seat, which was where you could look out at this beautiful expanse of Oak Bluffs Harbor. And so when this person got up, it must have been a kid because no one would be this honest. They woke up and they sat down and they're just kind of grumpy and closed off. And my friend Sheila said, "Well, what's going on?" And this person said, "You know, just sometimes it doesn't feel like you're really there for me." And Sheila said, "Are you kidding? I just set you up with this beautiful place setting and fresh flowers here so you could look out over this incredible view." And her kid said, "Yeah, but when I got here last night, I really wanted a hug and you didn't give me one." It really floored her. And what she realized was that she was giving what she would want to have received. She was giving what she valued. And we tend to, if you're looking through the lens of neuro-linguistic programming, which is an interesting one, my friend Sheila is very visual. So the visual things really, really matter to her. Some of us are more auditory. We're kind of tuned in to sounds. And some of us are more kinesthetic. It's really about feeling. So here is a kinesthetic person who was being treated to something visual, was really missing what they needed, was the kinesthetic. Maybe you've had that experience of wanting something from someone, and what they do doesn't sync up for you. You know they're being kind and generous, but it doesn't resonate for you. Maybe someone gives you a present that's beautifully wrapped, but presents don't mean anything to you. Or someone tells you how great you are, but you really wish they would just help you clean up the bathroom. So learning how we give and how we receive can be very, very helpful. And one of the most beautiful, simple articulations of this is about the five languages of love. That there are five primary ways that we express our affection and attention and love, and we receive it. One of them is through physical gifts. Another is through words of affirmation. The third is physical touch. The fourth is quality time. And the fifth is acts of service. And it's a very interesting reflection when you sense, how do you like to receive affection, attention, and love? And maybe we'll just do a quick little reflection on this. If you like, you can close your eyes. So as we review these, just to take a sense of which of these makes you tingle a little more than the others. If someone gives you a really thoughtful gift and makes a presentation of that to you, if someone pauses and really tells you what you mean to them, or reflects back to you some quality of how you show up, that's really positive. Or perhaps you find that touch, a hand on a shoulder, or a hug, or someone holding your hand, or perhaps quality time, time when you have exclusive eyeball-to-eyeball contact, where you can speak what's true, where you can hear deeply from another. Or perhaps acts of service, someone anticipating something you might need and actually doing something for you. Just sensing what most resonates for you. So if you like, you can deepen your breath, and if you like, you can open your eyes. I find in that review there's a quality of honesty, because usually the one that most resonates for you is maybe where you feel the most vulnerable. I know for me, because I always felt I had to be kind of self-contained and minimize my needs, just in my family structure, that the one that really does it for me is acts of service. When someone actually does something for me, it's sometimes even hard to take in. And for my wife, it's all about quality time. Just having that time to deeply connect and speak what's true and get in that resonant field, that's what really works for her. It's been very, very helpful in our relationship. And we've sort of ritualized it a little bit now. But been very, very helpful. And so it's important to recognize how you may unconsciously find yourself supporting others in a way that's most natural for you, which makes all the sense in the world. That you would do what you would like to receive, but it's very important to recognize that may not resonate for the other person. Or someone who worked with me in the past, and he was a manager, managed a whole lot of people, and the thing that really worked for him was words of affirmation. Like, he just loved being told how well he was doing. It just, he never got it as a kid, so that's the way he managed. So he would just go around and just tell people how great they were, and it seemed like a kind of a pretty good strategy. But then after a while, there were complaints coming up from people for whom that really didn't resonate. Because he would just, you know, let them know how great they were and move on, when some people really needed some time to really talk, real quality time. As a manager, you probably stay away from touch anyway. But it's a very interesting reflection. The takeaway here is really to reflect on your natural inclination to support someone may not be what they need. And this is sort of the power of the role reversal. My dad was a college professor, and our primary connection was through the mind. He was a super funny, very, very witty guy. And at some point, it really dawned on me that if I really wanted a quality connection with my father, it was going to have to be in writing. And I was amazed at his thoughtfulness in writing. And so when he began to have dementia and move into Alzheimer's, it was a very, very difficult thing to see, that someone so skillful with language was now kind of unable to speak. I remember at one point we brought him down here to D.C. for a couple of days after my mother died, and I was showing him a new keyboard I had for my iPad, and he got really, really, he really wanted to see it. And then when he tried to type, he just couldn't. I remember that kind of a sort of amused but hopeless look on his face. Toward the end, when I would go to visit him in his Alzheimer's units, which are all locked units and so forth, he was not happy there at all, because he would have long periods of being relatively lucid, you know, and just feel like he was in an insane asylum and get very, very angry and upset. And then as time went by, more and more he would not be as present, it was a little more relaxed and placid. But then it became more and more uncomfortable for me to be with him, because I was so acclimated to engaging through ideas and so forth. And as it got more chronic for myself, it suddenly occurred to me to do a role reversal. And so I asked myself, well, how does he want me to be with him? If I could put myself in his shoes, what would he want from me? And I realized he just wanted company. And that was such a deep, deep release for me. And then I was able to feel much more comfortable and accompany him in just being present. It wasn't easy all the time, but there was a sense that there was a way that I could actually meet him where he was without having to make it any different than how it was for him. So this can be a very helpful reflection. If you like, you can close your eyes, and we'll take just a few minutes here. And you might bring into mind someone you know who is going through a hard time right now. Someone who may be struggling or in fear or anxious. And you might take a moment to imagine, what are they feeling right now? What must it be like for them in their struggle? And if you were to explore this role reversal, is there a sense of what they might need from you? What might be most healing for them? And if you were to offer that, not perfectly and not all the time, but if you were to offer that in some way, what would that feel like inside for you? And again, you can deepen the breath. If you like, you can open the eyes. I have a good friend, Craig, who lives in Baltimore. He's a retired executive. And he's now mostly an artist and celebrator of life. But he's also kind of taken up a new career, if you will, a volunteer career of sitting with people as they're dying. And in particular, he likes to sit with people who have no family. And we went for a hike a little while back, and I asked him, so what are the keys, you know, as he has sat with many, many people going through their journey? And my slightly reworded are three things. The first is show up. The second is love them up. And the third is to monitor how you're holding the moment. Just as in meditation, you'll notice that there is a very natural and organic movement of the mind. The mind is naturally moving toward what it perceives as pleasurable and moving away from what it perceives as painful. And as you are sitting with those who are in suffering, that can be sometimes dramatically enhanced. That you'll find yourself moving away from the painful, moving toward the pleasure. And when you can return again to show up and love them up, that kind of becomes kind of the anchor of the practice. If you have had the gift of accompanying someone through their end-of-life stage, for some it can be a time of immense fear. It can also be a time of real deep awakening. On some level, it's almost like everyone at some point becomes a saint. Because you see clearly into the nature of reality. You see that all things are changing. This form, this body is changing. That the story of your life is just a story. And you see deeply into the nature of suffering. You see that to whatever degree you're hanging on, there is suffering. You see the degree that you can let go, there's freedom. And you begin to see deeply into the nature of anatta, this concept of not self. You get to experience viscerally the falling away of the body and this opening to the mystery of your journey. So as we are supporting people in suffering, it's not about taking away their experience. It's about supporting them in their experience. Our deepest lessons in life come through our suffering. As my father was dying, I was reminded of a story that goes through Buddhist mythology about the king Ashoka. Ashoka was a warrior king, and at the end of one particularly bloody battle, as he was walking the battlefield, he was just so overcome with the existential angst of so much slaughter. At that time, he met the Buddha and became a convert, if you will. And his kingdom was the first that was built purely on Buddhist principles. And one of those primary principles is dana, or generosity. So as he was actively taking on generous acts, he would have his scribe note what he did. And at the end of his life, he had his scribe read back the good deeds of his life. At the end of my father's life, as I was sitting with him, I had the idea of telling my father the story of his life through that lens of his good deeds. And my father was truly a well-loved person. He was a well-wisher of all. And telling him the story of his life was really quite powerful. I don't know how lucid he was, but he was crying, and that was the part of the last night of his life. And when he did pass, I had such a sense of release and happiness for him and being free from these last 3-4 years of struggle. So the question becomes, how do you be with people who are suffering? How is it possible to point toward wisdom and compassion, the two wings of mindfulness? I remember sitting with a friend who was in real severe pain from her cancer treatment. And I shared a little bit about the practice of Tonglen. If you're not familiar with it, it's an extraordinary practice. It's, in many ways, in its most simple form, it's simply saying, other people feel this too. It's the recognition that the pain and the suffering that you're experiencing is not unique, that there are others who feel this as well. And it can be a tremendous way of opening the field. The pain doesn't necessarily go away, but your consciousness has opened and expanded to be able to hold it in some way. That can be a very, very powerful practice. When I contrast how I was at age 25 with Bob and how I was with my father so many years later, I can appreciate how much I've changed internally. It might just be aging. It might be, you know, years of meditation. It might be my immersion into the Dharma. But I've really come to appreciate how much more willing I am to open to the mystery of this life. And I imagine you may find as well, as you reflect on your own practice, you know, there's this wonderful story of someone who stopped the Buddha in the road and said, how can I tell if I'm improving in my practice? Which is a really good question. I've asked myself that one plenty of times as well. And the Buddha said, one way you can check is your relationship to greed and aversion and confusion. Are you less caught up in the grasping, craving mind? Are you a little bit more free from aversion and judgment and blame and ill will and hatred? Is there perhaps a little more clarity as to the nature of things? That becomes a very powerful way of reflecting on your practice. And the way it will show up is when you are experiencing personal suffering, and when you are in relationship with others who are suffering, in your own way, to find your path to those two wings, to the wing of wisdom, to recognize what is true, what is real, and to the wing of compassion, the capacity to hold your experience. And so it really comes back to the beginning. It all comes back to you. How do you bear the suffering in your life and the suffering around you? Do you bear it with heaviness and fear and dread? Is it possible to hold it with compassion, with wisdom? And so if you find yourself, or when you find yourself, in that role of the caregiver, it's really helpful to recognize that there is a tremendous beauty of being there for people when they're suffering. And there are also some serious considerations. remember back in the ashram days, there was a man whose wife had a debilitating illness, and she was confined to a wheelchair. He's a very, very competent guy, and he took on all aspects of her support. And a lot of people admired, you know, how he did. You know, he was utterly dedicated to, you know, they went on adventures, and he managed, you know, her meds and the wheelchair and all of that. He was dedicated to giving her the best possible experience with life that he could. I only saw him a few times a year. But seeing those snapshots, you know, over subsequent years and years and years, it revealed some challenges. And the main challenge is burnout. He looked more and more tired. His daughter said he was getting more depressed, and part of his depression was anger. People tried to help, but he insisted on total control because he felt better that way, which I totally understand. And as I've talked to people who are in that caregiver role, I think one of the biggest issues is burnout. And burnout shows up in a lot of different ways. There's physical exhaustion, and there's emotional exhaustion. There's something that has been quite quantified, and that is compassion fatigue. That the heart can only take so much without regenerating. I have talked to a number of people who have been in the caregiver role or an extended period of time of supporting a parent through the death process. And one of the biggest challenges is the mental aspect, the resentment, the guilt that can show up. Again, it is utterly natural. Why doesn't this person just die? And the guilt that might come around that thought. There was someone I knew quite well whose mother had been terrible at managing her money. And toward the end of her life, completely depended on her daughter. And her daughter was really, really caught in feeling physically and financially exhausted with this deep sense of, she created this, why is it falling on me? So the question becomes, in this world of suffering, and in your relationship to being present to it, how can you keep your heart open? How can you bear that suffering? So again, we'll just close the eyes for a few moments here. It might be a helpful reflection. When you have been the caregiver in your life, how have you held it? Inevitably, there can be times of feeling kind of the flow of caring for another, but inevitably, there are times of burnout. And when you have encountered your challenges in being a caregiver, how does that show up? And as you are the caregiver in this life at different times, it can be noble to lose yourself, this quality of selfless service. But it also becomes interesting, how can you keep the energy flowing as a caregiver? How can you fill your cup so that it is overflowing? And what if that was your greatest responsibility? you'd like, you can deepen the breath and let the eyes open once again. And teacher Ram Dass talked about his first time in India when he was surrounded in immense poverty. Everyone asking for support. And when he would give out the coins that he had, he realized there was no way that he could quench the suffering out there. He said, all I could do is just do what I could do and let that be enough. And it's a very powerful reflection that this path is learning about the nature of suffering and learning about freedom from suffering. So with the endless suffering in the world, the question becomes, how can you see it clearly? How can you keep your heart open to the world and to those around you and to yourself? So there's a wonderful little writing from Sri Nisargadatta, this wonderful non-dual teacher, and I thought we might close with a short meditation and a reflection on his words. So if you like, you can close the eyes. Could be said that suffering closes us down. We constrict and we contract. Love is expanding and opening and points toward the immeasurable qualities of kindness and compassion and love. Reflecting on these words from Sri Nisargadatta. It is the nature of love to express itself, to affirm itself, to overcome difficulties. Once you have understood that the world is love in action, you will look at it differently. But first, your attitude towards suffering must change. Suffering is primarily a call for attention, which itself is a movement of love. More than happiness, love wants growth, the widening and deepening of consciousness and being. Whatever prevents that becomes a cause of pain, and love does not shrink from pain. In these final moments, you might take a moment to offer yourself kindness and compassion in your journey. May you more and more easily access this expansive, affirming quality of love. Those in your inner circle, if you wish, wishing them well, wishing them the courage to meet their challenges, wishing them ease. And letting this well-wishing radiate out to all beings. May all feel free from fear. May all feel open to peace. May all feel free from suffering. And as you're ready, you can deepen the breath. And when you're ready, you can open your eyes. Thank you for your attention. A couple of quick announcements. I'm offering a day-long retreat. I mentioned this weekend. That's waitlisted, but sometimes people do drop out. That's there. Awesome yoga before class, just to remember that. And after class, Ray and Tara are leading a discussion group.